Blog Talk Radio.
Another happy Sunday. Happy Father's Day to all the hardworking dads out there. Welcome to Just Believe Radio on the Right Stream Network. I am your host, Lisa Tarvis. I am a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner. I am intuitive, an author, and now, of course, also a radio host. So every Sunday, our show airs at 1 p.m. Eastern. Each week we have special guests who are experts in many different fields. We cover spirituality, holistic health, metaphysics, the paranormal. If you happen to be an expert in one of those areas and would like to be on the show, you can send me an email at lisa@lisatarvis.com. I'm waiting for, I have two guests scheduled for today, and I'm just waiting for one of them to call in. I don't know what's going on with the, my first guest is, there's this time zone problem when we're booking shows, and everybody, sometimes the time zones aren't clear, so I'm trying to get a hold of one of our guests and get somebody on the line here. But my guest for today are Chad Meek. He is actually promoting a movie called Giant Rock, the movie. He has a fascinating story, and I'm hoping to hear from him in a few minutes. He has his website is giantrockthemovie.com, and he's got a fascinating story. He's a fourth-generation Californian whose broad range of interests have given him a diverse resume that includes oil exploration, precious metal mining, renewable energy education, and metaphysics. Chad spent time in the California's Mojave Desert in the shadow of the giant rock, and his famous ET contactee, Uncle George Van Tassel, and Chad has had many alien abduction experiences of his own that led to his passion for UFOs, the occult, and metaphysical studies that has carried to the present day. His career as a resource entrepreneur has taken him across the globe to the Nevada desert, Bosnia, the Arctic Circle, and the jungles of Central America. Today, Chad continues to manage his many business interests, sits on the advisory board of Animal Rescue, and nurture the remarkable legacy of his uncle. So I'm fascinated to talk with him. I've seen many of, there's a kind of a trailer to the movie that I was able to watch on YouTube. That was fascinating, so I'm interested to talk to him. My other guest is Kim, I believe her last name is pronounced Wuertz, it's W-U-E-R-T-Z. And Kim started writing and being published as a poet during her teenage years. She was downsized from a marketing position in July 2009, and she was at the time in the process of writing a children's book for her niece. She decided it was time to do what she loved and fulfill her purpose. She became a freelance author. Since that time, Kim has written and illustrated books for children, a teen book of short stories, and she also became a novel series called The Life of Mimosa Lake series. She teaches from writing and publishing, how to develop, write, publish, and market your masterpiece, a creative writing workshop for adults. Additionally, Kim teaches other creative writing workshops, edits, and publish books, writes and edits web content and marketing materials for her students and other writers' businesses. She also gives presentations to schools, community groups, and professional conferences about her books, her life as a writer, and how to identify, pursue, and live your dreams. So those are the guests that I have scheduled for today. However, unfortunately, I haven't heard from either one of them. So in the meantime, while we're waiting for a guest to one of my guests to call in, I wanted to just talk about some stuff I've got coming up. I don't usually spend a lot of time talking about my things that I've got going on because I always have guests that I end up so fascinated by that I don't really end up spending a lot of time on my own stuff. But I think everybody knows by now that I wrote a book called Just Believe. And the book is it's a very simple read. It's a very very fun book. By the way, anybody has any questions for me? Anybody who happens to maybe have a psychic question that would like a short reading, you can feel free to call in at 347-945-7246 and press 1 and you'll be in the queue. Again, that number is 347-945-7246. So if you have any questions for me, either about my book or if you'd like a psychic reading, or you would, just like to chit-chat because apparently we have some time. Anyway, back to my book. So anyway, this was my first book. It was published in September 2012. And the book is, when I wrote the book, one of the things I wanted to do was I found that spiritual books, the book that, as someone with a degree in metaphysical science, I have a master's degree, and I had to do a lot of metaphysical reading. And I found that so many of the books were so very complicated and so hard to read. And, I would read, and I'd be like, wow, I did not comprehend any of that, and I'd have to go back and reread and things like that. So I wanted to make a really simple, easy kind of introduction to spirituality and the different things that I was interested in. I wanted to make it a little bit about my life, growing up, being able to communicate with angels, being able to, have some spiritual memories, I guess, of an afterlife and things like that. So I wanted to put that stuff in there, but then I wanted to put in there how that basically it helped me form the core beliefs that I have and that I now teach to my clients. So I started the book, and I have a foreword from my very good friend Von Goodwin in the book. He's the author of The Lenten Moon, The Egg Moon, and The Hunter's Moon. He's actually a host on Living the Question Radio. And he's been a good friend of mine for a while. He actually wrote a really very, very nice intro to the book, a foreword to the book that I really, really enjoyed reading and appreciated him writing. So, but I cover topics in the book, like why I believe what I believe. I talk about chakras because, that word is like getting out there a lot. I talk about forgiveness, energy vampires, happiness being simply a choice. I just published an article on that. Energy vampires, did I say energy vampires? I don't remember. Being an empath, just a bunch of different things. So if you haven't already checked it out, you can find Just Believe on Amazon.com or any of the places that sell new books. You can visit my website, lisacharvis.com, and find links to the book also. And if you have already read it, if you don't, you know, and if it's something that you enjoyed, if you hated it, don't bother. But if you liked it, if you could leave a review on Amazon.com, I love reading the reviews. So I do have a caller on hold, so let's see who it is. Hello, 814 area code.
It's soon.
Hello?
Can you hear me, Lisa?
I can.
This is June, honey.
Okay. I'm sorry, who's this?
This is June. Beth.
I don't know why I'm having trouble. Oh, how are you?
Good, I said I'd call and say hi.
I appreciate you're doing that. I don't know what happened to my guests.
That happens sometimes.
So talk about what's going on with you. One of my favorite guests. This is Dune. She hosts a show on Paranormal Radio, and she Paramania. I don't know why I always say Paranormal Radio. Paramania is Paranormal.
Well, it's paranormal. Yeah,
it's Paranormal Subject.
Paranormal
it's a really great show. Right. So, but what I'm curious about is, like, okay, so this week we were going to have, weren't you going to have Nicole on?
That was last week, and it was a smashing success.
Was it? Good. That's what I want to know. Nicole.
Yep, she was awesome.
Did you learn how to pronounce her last name?
Guillaume.
It's like, Guillaume. It's Guillaume. And anyway, she's a great guest that I've had on a couple of times, and she's really awesome. Did she do tarot readings? What'd she do?
Yeah, she did a couple tarot, and she did a couple tarots for people, and they were dead on, as I figured. She got Jody really good.
Did she?
She got the wow factor from Jody. Yeah, my co-host. Yeah. So yeah, she was really great. She was an awesome guest. So. I'm glad I stole
her. Good. I'm glad. Yeah, well, you can steal any of my guests anytime you want. I'm just like baffled. But, you know, I think sometimes the time differences really screw things up. And people, I don't know if, you know, I actually have to go on when I'm booked on a show. I literally go on and I'm like, all right, they're mountain time. The time is supposed to be, or they're Pacific time, or they're, you know, and I actually make sure I do the math because I've done it backwards before. Like I've thought, okay, this is time, and so I added an hour instead of subtracting an hour. You know what I mean? So I've gotten it messed up too. I've caught myself, thank God, beforehand. But this is I think one of the things that really messes people up is they don't either know that, you know, I'm on East Coast or I don't know. I always put Eastern, but who knows. So anyway, what else do you guys have on your show?
Let's see, Jody and I are going to do a virtual travel log coming up in a couple weeks where we're going to pick one of our bucket spots that we'd like to go investigate and then do like a, you know, I'm real big into food. I was a chef for years. And so we're going to do kind of a travel log and hit one of our spots and talk about different places that we'd like to go to. And then I'm going to have Gary Jansen on in 2 weeks. He just wrote another book called it's a kind of a study aid to Dan Brown's Inferno.
Oh, really?
He's going to be coming on. So, yeah. I had him on first. He wrote a book, too.
I haven't read Inferno. I don't know why. I haven't, like, gotten to it yet.
Yeah, so I'm... Yeah, I gotta reread it, and then I'll probably reread Dante's Divine Comedy, because actually Brown's book is based on that, and of course, you know, Gary gets into both, so should be a fun show. But
yeah,
that's basically what we got coming up.
No, that's
and
good.
I have to work for 2 weeks.
Yeah, no fun, huh?
I have a question for you, actually. When you were talking about like the books you had to read for your classes, what books did you end up reading?
Oh my gosh, there are just a ton of them. I mean, it was from, because there were so many different courses. There were so many different courses for, both in my bachelor's and my master's. So it was really very, very intense. Some of it was just very theology based, which
mm-hmm.
was tough. Other stuff was, you know, one of the hardest things that that I read was when I was taking divination courses. I had to like study
mm-hmm.
tarot and feng shui and like, even though feng shui isn't a divination, but it was part of the course. All these different, like, the I Ching, those
mm-hmm.
things are complicated. It's like
mm-hmm.
really simple. It's like you learn how to use them, but it's hard. There's a lot of memorization that goes in with that. And that's one of the things I signed up for was Nicole's course on tarot, because even through that whole studying tarot, I did not learn how to read tarot cards. I never got through the test and I, you know, passed and everything, but I could not still sit down and tell, you know, do a reading and not have a book to like cheat off of, you know? So
I have my little cheat sheet.
Yeah. It's hard. I think there's so much memorization to it, you know? And that was tough. But then you're getting into really deep metaphysical stuff. I mean, you're getting into really deep metaphysical stuff. You're getting into really deep holistic health stuff, from, you know, counseling type of things to even like grief management, you know, grief counseling, all that kind of stuff. And then your, you know, a dream analysis. My God, I thought I was so excited about taking dream analysis. Wow, was that a complicated
mm-hmm.
book, you know? And every course was like a couple of books. But you can't, you know, you think it's just going to be, oh, well, if you dream about, you know, your teeth falling out, you have anxiety, you know? And it's like it's so much deeper than that, though. I mean, actually, that is accurate. If you dream about your teeth falling out, it is an anxiety dream.
Yeah,
but
I had to look that up.
That's one of my big ones. I'm telling you, I know I'm anxious when I start having dreams about
yeah,
that.
Exactly. It's funny. It's funny you picked that one, because every now and then I get those dreams where, you know, either my teeth shatter. They fall out, and I think because it's like I'm real weird about my teeth, because when I was a baby I lost all my front
yeah,
teeth.
Yeah, I am
so
too.
I didn't have front teeth until I was like 10-11 years old, and of course I developed a speech impediment because of it, because I had to learn how to talk with my front teeth, and you don't realize.
Right.
So it's like now it's just like I remember the first time I had the dream where, and plus I have TMJ, so I grind my teeth. And so it's like the first time I ever had a dream about my teeth breaking or falling out, I was like, what in the world does that mean? I was like, well, that would explain why.
Yeah.
Funny.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. It's like it's one of my most common dreams that drive me crazy. I just sit there, I'm like, why am I having this dream about my teeth? And at first I thought it was like, you know, like years ago, I just used to think it was a dream about, you know, me being just a little too in tune to what I look like, you know? So it was kind of like, I thought it was like
vanity.
Me just being, yeah, it was like a vanity thing. And And then when I finally, and it was funny because when you literally break it down, when you're going through something where you're anxious, you're like, ah, that does make sense, you know, why I'm having a dream, when you actually find out what the dream is. But the other thing is, the dream is based on, you know, it's based on what's going on in your life. So you interpret the dream to be, you know, about stuff that you've got going on in your life. So it's kind of crazy,
right?
But, you know, it's all good. It's all good. All right. Well, I appreciate you calling in. I've got another caller on the line, and I'm praying it's one of my guests. So,
Okay, let's go.
Yeah. Hey, tell everybody your website again.
It's paramaniaradio.com, and we have a couple new shows coming up in the next few weeks, so it should be cool. We're slowly but surely growing, and our
guests
are on Monday and Tuesday night. So. All right, thanks, Lisa. I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. All right, I'm going to go see 714. Who do I have on the line?
Hi, it's Chad Meek.
Yay, Chad, one of my guests. Chad was actually supposed to be my second guest, and when nobody was calling in, I was getting a little anxious, so I'm like, call, please, now. So, you know, I don't know. I swear, everybody's time differences get messed up. You know, the time zones, and when you're doing these things, and it's on the, you know, it's not like you're in a studio. So everybody's like, you know, calling in, and it's crazy. But anyway, I'm glad you were able to call in early for me. That is very, very cool. So tell everybody about. I read your bio at the beginning, and it's fascinating. But you're coming out with this movie called Giant Rock the Movie, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, we're moving forward with it. Yeah, Giant Rock the Movie.
Well, tell everybody what the background of it is. I know you have an uncle that was involved in some UFO experiences along with yourself. So. Go ahead and tell everybody, you know, what you got going on, what the movie's all about. And
okay, we'll start from the start. You know, I used to the place of what it's called is actually called Giant Rock, and the Hopi Indians or the Paleo Indians in California. This is before anybody even knew what. You know, the whole name of Indians was the misnaming of Indians. Anyways, they're roaming around there, and they would go to this gigantic rock. They called it the Great Stone, which was, it's an 8-foot freestanding boulder. And these various paleo Indian tribes would go there, and they'd worship, and they would, this is going back like 10,000 years ago, and they would go there and they'd worship at this anomaly, which is this mammoth rock, which, you know, there's all kinds of arguments whether it's the largest freestanding boulder. But anyways, if you can just kind of get a handle on a 8-story you know, rock out in the middle of the desert, then it might, you know, you might agree that it is an anomaly. But anyways, it kind of starts there. And what had happened was in the early 20s, a gentleman named Frank Kreitzer, who was a German of German descent, was told to go out to this in a dream to the Great Stone out there. And so he wandered from Europe and landed in Santa Monica, California, and serendipitous moment met my uncle, who was working for his uncle at the time, a mechanic. And so they made fast friends, and literally my uncle and, you know, he was a young man at that time, and his uncle were so impressed that they didn't charge him for the auto repairs. In addition, they gave him, I believe, about $31 and a bunch of groceries and said, hey, you know, we believe what you're telling us about your dream. So at any rate, to bring it kind of to move the story along, this guy, who was a follower of Dr. Rudolf Steiner and Nikola Tesla, you know, he wasn't a dummy by any means. He goes out there and he carves the inside of this rock out and lives in it. And, you know, and lives in it for many, 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 many years. And my uncle and him had stayed in contact and, you know, over the years from about 1930 to about 1941. And so they'd go out and we'd go out and they'd camp out there, which where this is in California, it's about 41 miles from Palm Springs and about 100 miles from Los Angeles due east. So that's a logistical, you know, end as far as where it was at. But so the story goes like this. He actually had a shortwave radio and he spoke German. And as we got closer to, you know, the war, Kreitzer became very suspicious of the authorities because they would hear this German broadcast to German expatriates all over North America, and they thought that they, you know, that he was giving them code or secret information about California. And of course, from a historical perspective, you got to remember that, you know, we interned thousands and thousands of Japanese, you know, during that time period, so it was ripe. So the authorities went out there and wanted to talk with him and have a chat with him. And
right.
Frank had been out there and he'd been out in the desert and had all kinds of various unique experiences and, you know, with UFOs and things like that. He became slightly paranoid, but so he wouldn't come out. And so the what had happened is they threw some tear gas down inside the rock, and also he was prospecting for minerals, so he had dynamite down there. So anyways, one thing led to the other, and there was this huge explosion, and it was literally eviscerated down inside the rock. Well, that was the end of Frank, and my uncle had always been out there, and he started getting dreams and things like that to go out and do something and to make contact with UFOs. So lo and behold, my uncle and aunt and my cousins and all these people, they went out there in 47, and that's really where a lot of the story begins with my uncle and the whole UFO contactee movement. And so it was an exciting time. What had happened is, you know, during the time of that, we have this, instance in Roswell and various places in New Mexico where the government was actually picking up aliens and things like that, and it was just a very active time period for the UFO thing that was going on in the world, and so. Anyways, to make as an overview, I kind of bring it from the story from Frank Kreitzer all the way up to currently, and there's a little bit of me in the screenplay, and so it's a very exciting thing. It's a very personal screenplay, for me because I had written it, and it's a lot of it's based on true events, and so.
Tell us about some of your like direct experiences, like with UFOs and things. What happened to you personally?
Well, what happened to me is, for the most part, I actually had abductions out there where I would literally I was a little kid and you got to remember the whole area was all desert and. I would have missing time periods of up to about anywhere from 3 to 6 hours. And this started when I was around four and where I'd actually been picked up by some of the UFOs out there, which it seems odd even mentioning it today. But that's actually what happened. I was actually picked up and I was essentially, I guess, singled out. I remember quite vividly, you know, holding on to a swing set, and they did it quite often. And I went through some various regression therapies and things like that. And, well, twice I did it, and I got on the table, and I could get, what would happen is I'd get to the table, and I would, we would get into some of the experiments and things like that, and I don't remember anything, and it becomes so painful for me, I would stop the regression therapy. So I haven't had much luck getting back to what they did with me after I was on their table. So, but I do have a lot of missing time periods, and at different times my family would know I was missing, and then there would be kind of scary for them, and then other times they didn't even miss me, which was more scary for me, so as far as the time. So, but yeah, it was a unique time period. I actually like some of the other people, like Travis Walton, and the Fire and Sky movie that actually occurred about 10 or 15 years ago. I don't know if you ever caught that one.
Right.
They asked Travis Walton, did you do this regression therapy? And he goes, no. And they go, why not? And because he says, I don't want to go back there. So I kind of have the same, thing going on with me. But the only other family member, the only thing that I was somewhat singled out, with the exception of one experience with my older sister and my mother, where we were walking out in the desert and we had a low-flying UFO kind of come buzzing, and it was, back in the day, it was so crystal clear, you simply couldn't, you could see literally everything. And my mother was somewhat skeptical about a lot of that stuff, but then after that, her skepticism had left. And
so
what's fascinating is I tell people I come from my background, especially in my I guess so-called adult life, which is a whole different story, but I've literally kind of hid some of these events and things. I haven't really, been a huge fan of talking about it. In fact, I've been married for 33 years, and I don't think I mentioned it to my wife for the first 3 years for fear of that she would run away and say, "Well, I don't want."
People aren't so open to this whole concept.
Right. I thought I'd give her a few years to kind of, test the waters to see, maybe unleash a little.
Make sure she liked you that much.
Right. Make sure that, yeah. But, it's really funny, too. I mean, I've had so many different weird experiences, and again, including the movie. I mean, including writing the screenplay. There's just so many weird events I've had around my uncle, and there's this connection that I have with him. And, one of our trailers that we're building right now is really fascinating because I didn't want to tell my uncle about, we lived within about a mile of each other. And we're talking about, five or six different families all, connected. And I would go to my uncle, and I kind of was a little obnoxious little kid too, precocious, and of course I would see him on television, talking about, UFOs and things like that or whatever else he was doing at the time, but I would tease him and I would tell him I don't believe in spaceships, Uncle George. I would say that quite often. I'd kind of tease him until one day. And literally, I mean, the reverberations in my ear I still get. He had these big sunglasses. He lowered his sunglasses and he listened to me. I go, I don't believe, I don't believe in spacemen. I don't believe in UFOs. And my uncle put his sunglasses down and with his booming voice said, "You will." So the only thing I could do, I was stopped in my track for some reason. It just hit me, and I literally ran away, and I was crying because I got it. I mean, there was this psychic thing that was going on. But he always looked at me very oddly with the, comparatively to the rest of the children that were out there, and he knew that something was going on, but I couldn't talk about it. And I was so, at the time I thought, well, if I don't talk about it, if I don't tell anybody, maybe it'd go away. Well, that didn't work. I actually, you know, have been having several events quite regularly, you know, especially up until I was about 21. I had, you know, and everywhere. I'd run into them everywhere as far as the either a sighting or I actually could identify some people who were a little bit different that I presumed were UFOs. And as it turns out, there's been several studies. One was there was a Harvard study in 91 that they, you know, it was pretty rigorous as far as the amount of people that had been abducted that came out of Harvard. And you know, there's been all kinds of controversy about it. But the control questions were so extraordinarily hard, I don't know how they qualified anyway. But as it turned out, the numbers were staggering as far as the amount of people that have actually been abducted, especially here in the United States. And, you know, worldwide, they think that the number could be as high as 4 million people. And which is
do they remember? Do these people remember this abduction or not?
Well, it's selective memory. They try not to remember that because it's very in the study, what they did, they actually had willing participants come in the Harvard study I'm referencing. They actually had answered their question. They had some strict control questions like, you know, the UFOs always come in, you know, we know that the UFOs always come in green colors, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, they're little green men. And so if someone agreed with them, then they would be out of the, you know, they would be, you know, knocked off their control body. But if they would say things like, no, they're not green men, they're, you know, they're actually either, you know, they're grays or they're blondes, or they would actually give more apt description than they were included in the study. But they actually tried to get these people to do that. Now, that's the people who were willing participants in the study. There's a whole slew of people out there that have had these experiences that it is so far from their own reality. Very much the equivalent of just like the, Columbus first discovered America. He was just right outside the little islands, out there, and the Indians didn't recognize that there were these ships out there simply because it wasn't part of the reality. So there's a lot of people that actually have these experiences that block them out and to do that. So, you know, God knows. I mean, I don't know who. I think it's a lot more regular than what people will say. Plus, we have a gigantic propaganda machine, you know, too, telling people. I had an experience in Utah where I had a premonition. A lot of times they'll come to me in a dream or some guide or a voice. It could be several of them, but they'll tell me that there'll be ships out there. And so I hiked up the mountains, and one morning I had the dream. I walked up the mountains, stood up there for about 2 hours, nothing came. And as I walked down, there was this huge rainbow ship that was approximately about 3 football fields long, cruising very slowly up the valley up in Utah. And I thought, and I watched it go and just stood there and said, oh, okay, well, there it is. Well, the very same night, and I remember the guy's name was Dick Norris, who was the announcer on CBS affiliate in Salt Lake. He came out and he said, oh, yeah, there's been thousands of people that have called the switchboard talking about this, rainbow ship, and scientists have proven that occasionally rainbows go around and that they do this. Well, that's not true. Scientists don't say that, but the news guide said that, and so I think a lot of people kind of get BS'd out of their UFO experience by the, you know, regular orthodoxy. So it's strange what happens, and this goes I mean, my uncle had so many experiences. You know, he had one of the things that that he is probably most famous for or notorious, and that's actually going to be, you know, done in the movie also, is that he was told by this group of space entities that he had channeled and talked to regularly, and they had instructed him to tell all the authorities that these above-ground nuclear tests that were occurring in the 50s are totally harming not only our immediate universe, but they're actually harming parallel universes also. They're actually tearing, you know, the various dimensions when they explode these above-ground nuclear tests. And so what he did was he asked him, well, what should I do about it? He says, I don't want to do anything about this, because he was talking to these channeling. He goes, I'll be in trouble if I do this, and people think I'm absolutely insane. And they point blank says, send telegrams to all the authorities within your, you know, area to tell them that this, you know, above ground nuclear test must stop. And what we're going to do is we're going to buzz Washington, D.C. And this is, I believe he sent telegrams to President Truman, to Life magazine, to the L.A. Tribune, and, you know, the Air Force. Anyways, and so he sent all these registered mails, which instantly I saw, you know, the things he sent. And sure enough, around the 19th, that there was this huge buzz of ships over Washington, D.C. And it was one of the more well-documented, you know, saucer buzz. And they literally stayed there for a couple of days. And the various governments were, you know, the military people were always were chasing him. They couldn't get close, you know, to these spaceships. So, but he actually sent in a telegram, which was extraordinary that he had did that. And what he ended up with, two things, ended up on the cover of Life magazine, because they, you know, they had got the telegram and they had, you know, were very interested in him. And the other thing was is that when the Eisenhower administration came in right afterwards, he was put on America's most dangerous list of people. And
oh,
so, yeah, you know, one of the things that my uncle was very naive about, he just assumed that, well, you know, we're all in this together and we're all on the same team. But he was, you know, he was so naive. He thought, well, he'd be, you know, would be applauded by his efforts, and that wasn't the case. You know, they just simply,
yeah.
You know, and I think it was because, you know, through, you know, when we do some, when we were doing the research on this, there were interesting conversations between Churchill, FDR, and Truman about, because in Great Britain they were having these Foo Fighters during the war, and there were all these visitations in Great Britain at the time, and Churchill was really spooked. And his whole analogy was that that people would stop going to church and stop supporting their government, stop paying taxes and all that, if they actually believed in these UFOs and extraterrestrials and things like that. Well, you know, who knows what people would do, but they were very, very fearful. And so during the 50s, you know, the government here, they created a separate entity, that was a hybrid of, both the CIA and the FBI, called COINTELPRO. And what their job was to discredit anybody that had mentioned that they had an experience with an extraterrestrial, regardless of, you know, whether they were completely, you know, out to lunch or whether it was factual. It didn't, you know, they didn't care. So there, and so people like my uncle were, you know, always, there are a lot of peculiar things were always, you know, happening to them, their communications and things like that, because they weren't deemed as part of the club. Yeah, so and in part, you know, the reason why I'm even The reason why I did this, there's several, there's a whole myriad of reasons why I wrote the screenplay and why we're doing the movie and all kinds of things. But one of the main things that my uncle wanted to do was, he always tried to make people feel very, very comfortable about the, you know, extraterrestrial experience, because what it does, it really puts a mind, it can really screw you up. And there were all these pilots and Marine people that had they're UFO experiencers, both on the third and fourth kind, which is, you know, they would actually not only see them, but some people would actually come in contact with them. And so they would go talk to him about it. And he was kind of like this, this kind of counselor, but people would seek him out to become reintegrated within their whole existence, because it turned their world upside down, and just by being an experiencer. So anyway,
right.
That's one of the reasons we're
so
doing
it.
Do you think
the government tells us the truth about UFO at all?
No, they don't. They lie. They have an agenda. And it's also too, and we're always trying to figure out why not? I mean, you know, what's the deal? Well, you know, of course you're getting all kinds of control issues and power issues and governance issues, certainly, but there seems to be a lot of evidence that we've been making deals with them. There's a whole, I mean, there's so many brands and sects of UFOs, you know, just think about it. But there's some that have actually had technology transfers, and I think that's part of the deal, you know, as far as part of the deal is deal with us, don't deal with individuals and what have you. And, of course, I think, you know, I mean, you've got to look at it this from one perspective. I mean, all the huge technological advances that we've had, especially over the last 50 years, have been, you know, vertical. I mean, they've just been off the map. I mean, we talk, you know, if you go back to transistors and things like that, and then you get into computer chips and all this technology that we're just moved so fast, so quickly, probably more so at any time in our known history. Not getting back into the Vedics or any of the ancient, you know, time periods, but as far as within the last 10,000 years, especially over the last 50 years, there's been some sort of deal. And specifically with the United States, you know, with our, superiority in technology, I think we've had our own deals. And I think part of it is that they just don't want this to be kind of a common occurrence. And it really goes down to controlling the free spirit and, you know, the free people of here. There's so many, I could go into all kinds of, you know, arguments back and forth why they wouldn't do it. But that really, from what I've studied and what I've researched, that's kind of what it is. I think it's more like, you know, that's why we have this Area 51 thing, and, you know, we have all this.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about national security and all this, but, I don't know. But, I do. I think they don't like it. I mean, I simply think that, they want to round everybody up under one group and one team leader. And but also, too, you get into – go ahead. Excuse me.
I know. It's okay. It just kind of makes you I don't like things being hidden. If there's actual evidence and things are being hidden from us, do they think that we're not intelligent enough to comprehend it? I mean, what's the
Well, they're banking on it. Yeah. Well, what they do is they give you material complacency. And also too, within our government, there are hidden pockets of government also. So we have the apparent, you know, we have the what we think are the actual leaders of our democracy, and then we have really institutionalized, inside government, which is really fascinating in its own self too, because first of all, Reagan had UFO experiences, Jimmy Carter had UFO experiences. Bill Clinton had UFO experiences. Douglas MacArthur had UFO experiences. I mean, they actually had, you know, and they admit it. And most of them, especially Carter, Reagan, and Clinton, both said that we're, you know, when I get to the presidency, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Okay. Oh, incidentally, John F. Kennedy also, you know, said that what I'm going to do is I'm going to get to the bottom of this because there's just too much. There's too many people with too much evidence that, you know, that we're going to get some disclosure going, but every one of them have been shut out. In fact, Kennedy is really interesting, and I thought Kennedy is really an interesting president for so many reasons. I mean, besides his charm, but really more or less his goodwill and his intentions. Most of what he had was really well intended. I mean, as far as what he thought. And so as a congressman, he was on a committee, and they wouldn't let him, in 47 with the Roswell thing, they wouldn't let him give him any information. He was trying his best to find out about that, and they shut him out. They said, hey, you don't have that. Then he became a U.S. senator, and he tried it. And then when he became president, Dulles, who was the CIA chief, also told the president of the United States, and this is on record, that he didn't have the need to know about this, and he was the president, and that's why he physically went to every military base looking for information on UFOs. So, you know, the story gets very, very weird as far as who's controlling things, you know, and who's actually, you know, doing things. So when I say the government, I believe it's I'm not even referring to our elected government. There seems to be this shadow government that seems to dictate who gets what information. Part of the story and part of the reason, Lisa, as far as why I'm doing the movie also is a part of an overall disclosure. I'm actually pushing back because I'm thinking, okay, there's been a lot of really great documentaries, out there. Dr. Greer, he just came up with a fairly good documentary, but, you know, documentaries put you to sleep. And so
use them. I definitely use them for that exact reason. I put Netflix on to try to fall asleep, and documentaries do it every time.
they do it. You sit there and look at it. And me too, and I do too. I'll sit there and go, you know, I'll get through about, if it's a 2-hour documentary, I'm good for 15 minutes. And I'm usually asleep. And I consider myself right. I mean, it's a cure for my insomnia. I think about this. So, you know, by design, I thought, well, you know, and then I thought, well, I'll do a book. You know, I thought, well, you know, I'll write a book, and I thought about that, and I thought, well, okay, what are the new books? You know, what do people do nowadays? They go see movies and what have you. And I said, well, you know, and what the objective, of course, I'm like every other mortal. I want to be rich and famous and, never have to worry financially again and all that. But aside of all the worldliness and all that stuff, the real intent is to is to really get the message out, and especially with my uncle and some of the people that were out there, which were really true spirits, especially during the 50s and the 60s. I mean, they were just such believers, and they wanted to create this really great world, and that kind of morphed into the Woodstock generation. Then of course, you know, they all sold us out, as far as in that new beautiful,
right,
you know, world. But I thought, okay, well, what's the best way? Well, I could do a documentary, and that would get a limited amount of play, or I could, do a very creative script, take a lot of dramatic license, give it enough drama, intrigue, and all that stuff to get people just to take a look at it, you know, to something else. And then if they want to, they want to go and look, there's a ton of stuff with my uncle on the internet. It's all in the public domain, and they could go out and research for themselves, and they can decipher what they, what they deem is good or bad information as far as that. But I thought we'd get the ball really rolling, and in mass and more, international too, because UFO movies or this kind of things are extraordinarily popular. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do something, I'll do it right. And actually, I was worried about, my uncle, I of course, loved him. And so when you love somebody, you don't want to say anything bad about them. You don't want to, well, you know what? I got a little stuck when I was writing the screenplay, and I go, you know what? I can't, I'm going to write what I'm going to write. And I mean,
Right.
And I, one of the things, my uncle was a womanizer. God bless him. There was not a woman that he didn't love. He just loved women. And he was, and my long suffering aunt, Eva, God bless her, she put up a lot of stuff. So I got that in there. I said, hey, that is what it was, and we knew about it. I don't know. I think that maybe he had a sense of he was more of a libertarian or libertine. He was on the same program as Fidelity and things like that. But regardless, I just kind of showed it, wrote it the way it is, and it's going to be shown the way it is. And in retrospect, I'm probably better off because it's people. He was kind of a. Number one, he was a reluctant messiah. He really wasn't. He was kind of inducted into this whole thing, and he didn't really want to do this. He was, up into 47, he was Howard Hughes' flight engineer. He was number one flight engineer. Howard Hughes stuck money in a lot of his experiments, including the Integraton. Later on, in fact, he used to fly out to Giant Rock, was a huge dry lake, so you could land anything you wanted out there. And so Howard Hughes always was a regular out there. And my uncle, he had a restaurant out there, and so supposedly I was eating pancakes and eggs next to Howard Hughes. I wouldn't know what it was.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that in your information. I mean, that's just so cool that there's, your uncle was so connected with so many different people. But tell everybody, when's the movie going to be out? How can they keep up with up with what's going on, when it's coming out? Give them all the, what you've got, what you've got coming up. So,
okay, we've got one of the things, initially as the ball's rolling, you're limited to the amount of money you can spend on this, and that. So it's been a little slow, but, slowly but surely, we've got a couple of executives from Warner Brothers that are in there helping, ex-Warner Brother people helping us now. So anyways, we've got we've been this pre-production hell trying to get everything going, so we're now just cutting our trailers. I think I sent you a little bit of one on, to you.
Yeah, I watched it.
Yeah. We're cleaning that stuff up. Our best guesstimate is that we will probably begin filming everything in March of next year. And that's the fastest we can actually get our permits in to do it. And then we hope to have a Christmas release around 2014, and I'm being optimistic, but I have to, as far as this goes, we've got interest, and there's a little bit of buzz going on. We've got some really good, big name actors that are gonna be in it. We've sent out the contracts to them, waiting back for, they've given us the temporary go ahead. So
right.
We'll be announcing that in about a month, get going. And of course, they can go to our website, which is giantrockthemovie.com, and they can just check us out and, keep up with us. And we're going to make it fun also, too. And this is something very seriously we're going to. One thing that my uncle used to do these conventions every year. He did them every single year, so we're going to need a lot of extras. So if you got any budding actors that'd like to get their face on the screen, maybe they can plan a trip out to California or something in the spring, and we'll get them on.
I'll do it.
It'll be a big party.
My husband's an airline pilot. I fly anywhere I want for free. So.
Oh, that's excellent. Good. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's nice and simple for me.
Okay, good. We'll have you out. Yeah, but you know, it's kind of a, you know, even though we're all anti-studio. I mean, in fact, even the studio guys I have are anti-studio because they say, hey, you want to kill a creative idea? Hook up with a studio. You know, so,
yeah, exactly.
So we've got this little, you know, pirate, you know, little flag where, you know, we're the anti thing there, but. Our budget's, you know, I mean, believe it or not, we're still considered a low-budget movie at about $32 million, which is, you know, makes me, yeah, it makes me nauseous even telling you the number.
That's a lot of money.
But it is, you know, when you consider we're going to have about 100 to 150 people on location. We'll be running a second unit also because we've got an Africa scene. I've got a very big imagination as far as this, so I've actually got an African scene, which will be in Louisiana. I mean, we're not going to go to Somalia. We're going to go to Louisiana. That'll be our. That's the, you know, a little bit of, you know, the inside information that all your listeners can hear. Yeah, that African scene is really filmed in Louisiana. It looks exactly the same too. So we've had location scouts with that and brought back pictures, and you can't tell the difference. So part of movie magic. So, but yeah, that's what we're doing. You know, it's been a lot of work, but a lot of fun, a lot of interesting things here. You know, my whole background has not been this. I mean, I've done a lot of, metaphysical counseling and, I've ran oil and gas companies. I mean, gosh, I've done a lot of stuff, but this thing has just been absolute labor of love and it's been so much fun to do. And, you know, that because you got to have a lot of passion because to get over the humps and what have you. I just don't, you know, I've been, we can have you do also. You can, we'll have you come out. You can be a consultant for us. You can make sure all the sets are arranged correctly for the best energy. Is that
a
possibility?
Nice. Yes, I like that.
Anyways, but that's what we're doing, and
All right, well, that's awesome. I think everybody definitely check out the website, which is Giant Rock the Movie, right?
Yes.
Okay. Check out the website, and there is a trailer. Do you have the link to the trailer on that site?
No, we haven't. You know, actually, because it's the rough draft, it'll be up. We'll have the trailer up in about a week. I just kind of wanted to give you an idea what we're doing.
The trailer's definitely. There's a lot in the trailer. I mean, there's a lot of information that's coming to you in pictures, and you, when you watch it, you're like, whoa, how is this involved? You know what I mean? Like
it builds
some interest because you're like, whoa, what does this have to do with this giant rock?
Right. You know? How does all this stuff work with giant rock? I know.
Right.
Yeah.
It does. It's exactly what I got. I'm like, wait a minute.
It makes sense when you have a conversation with me, but yeah, it is. It involves a lot of stuff and a lot of who's who, and it goes. I mean, literally. I mean, you know, we have John F. Kennedy, Howard Hughes. There's a lot of people that are going to be, you know, in the film. You know, at least not them per se, but you know, actors portraying them. So
right,
anyway,
right. That is really cool. I'm really excited to see what happens with it. I'm definitely going to keep up with it. And when you get it, you know, going, definitely let me know so we can get you back on the show to advertise it.
We'll do.
And, of course, I'm going to be part of it, so I'll be advertising it.
There you go.
My acting debut and my consulting. Yes, consulting. I just made up a word. Anyway, it was great having you on the show. I really appreciate
Thanks.
Your being on, calling in early for me. That was awesome.
And I will definitely stay in touch and keep me up to date what's going on. Everybody, GiantRockTheMovie.com, check it out. And we'll be back with our second guest in just a bit. And we're going to go to a commercial break. But, Chad, thanks again for being on.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure, Lisa. And you know, I look forward to getting more information to you. It's going to be a lot. It's going to be a gas. We're going to have a blast. Okay.
I can't wait. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye. All right, everybody. We're gonna go into our second hour here. But first, we're gonna take a quick commercial break. Hold on, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's L-I-S-A.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And, of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat.
Hi, this is Jennifer Coolidge. The American Heart Association says the disco song Stayin' Alive is the near-perfect beat for hands-only CPR. If you see a teen or adult collapse from cardiac arrest, you only need two steps to help save a life. Call 911 and push hard and fast in the center of the chest to the beat of the song Stayin' Alive. Disco is back and it's saving lives. To learn more, go to heart.org/hands-only-CPR.
Nationally supported by the WellPoint Foundation.
Imagine a world where bullying isn't considered a normal part of childhood.
A world where I'm not afraid to go to school.
To speak out.
To be myself.
A world where I'm not afraid to be caught alone.
Come on, punk. We have the power to stop the bullying.
Speak out.
Speak up.
Educate.
Find out what to look for and how you can make a difference at bullying.org.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up. I shouldn't be afraid to get out of school.
To turn on my computer.
Message. A lock to my locker. Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
Where you're not alone.
Hey everyone, we are back and we have my second guest on now. Her name is Kim Wart, and she is, I read her bio earlier, but for anybody who's just tuning in, I want to give you some more information. Kim's a writer. She's been writing and being published since her teenage years. And after she got downsized from a marketing position in 2009, she was in the process of writing a children's book for her niece. So she decided it was time that she was going to become a freelance author. And since that time, she has written and illustrated books for children, a teen's book of short stories, and on the third book of her first novel series, The Life of Mimosa Lake series. So I want to bring Kim on. Kim, are you with me?
I am. Hi, Lisa. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, can I say Happy Father's Day to my father? I just did, I know.
I know. That's awesome. And I'd like to say Happy Father's Day to my father, too, but I don't think he ever listens to my show. So I'm not really sure if it's going to do me any good. But anyway,
well,
I'll say
you
Happy Father's Day. I'll say Happy Father's Day, just in case he happens to be listening this time. So
there you
tell
go.
Me... I want to talk about, you know, the Mimosa Lake series, I think, the most. And in the first book of the series, you introduce your readers to the neighbors of the Mimosa Lake community. So why don't you, before we get into the specific book you're on now, which I think is Warm Days of Lita Clay, is it?
Yeah, Warm Days and Lita Clay is the second book. Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, tell her to give background on what the whole series is about.
Okay. Well, basically, I live in Missouri and in rural area about 75 miles southwest of St. Louis. And I live in a lake community. And I never thought I would write fiction, honestly, Lisa, because I'm a certified grant writer. I used to, I ran a business doing strategic planning, grant writing, and consulting for nonprofits and small businesses. So I did that for a number of years. So my writing was more of a more technical writing. When I was young, I did creative writing and was published, but then I didn't do that for a long time. And when I got laid off from a marketing position, I started just by illustrating my children's book, and then I don't know, I just was at my desk working one day and watching my neighbors outside, and I thought, you know, what would it be like if I could create a world where people were, you know, kind to each other and people had their best interests at heart, and, you know, rather than all this constant crabbing around that seems to happen, you know, especially at that time, it was 2009 or 10, and, you know, the recession was bad and people were not in good moods anywhere, I don't think. Anyway, so I just started thinking and writing this, and then I had an experience with an eagle, which is actually in the book, and I stood out on the back of my upstairs deck one morning, and this eagle flew about 6 feet over my head, and just silent, dead silent bald eagle, huge, 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 and we had never had eagles in this area. We have them up by the Mississippi, which is, like I said, about 40, 50 miles as the eagle flies away. So I started this series, and I started kind of exploring characters and exploring different types of people and how they work and how they interact and how faith or belief in God or some other, you know, being, whatever. I happen to believe I'm a Christian, so I believe in Christ, but how that works through your life. How, so this, the first book was about faith and hard times. how does faith really carry you through hard times, and then the interactions of people, and how you can profess one thing and act another, which we all do. And so how do you, you know, how do you grow yourself spiritually, basically, as you go through? And that's what all of the books, in essence, are about. They deal with spiritual and personal growth through the lives of these neighbors. There's a main character, River Ivory, but there are really a cast of about 6 or 7 really main characters that support and run through the book, and then people that come in and out of their lives. So it's, in some ways it's difficult to write. In other ways it's easier because you know, you've got a lot of people to draw on, but that's why there's so much, for me, fodder for so many stories. They have so many stories to tell, you know. So that's kind of how I started.
What was the first book called?
I'm sorry?
What was the first book called?
Life at Mimosa Lake, the story of the Winter Visitor.
Okay, and the second one then is
Warm Days
at Lita Clay.
Lita Clay is a type of clay in the Northwest that basically you're standing on, and it can just literally slide down the hill and fall out from underneath. You fall out from underneath your feet very quickly, and you don't even feel it initially, but it's kind of like quicksand.
Okay, all right, and so that's the book that you're selling right now. But you're working on the third of the series now, right?
I'm working on the third, and I'm working on a Christmas novella. So the third one is at my editor. It's due to my editor by the 1st of July. So that one is called Spring Sprouts and Fall Ashes, and that'll be out in early fall. And then this year, I'm doing a Christmas story, just a shorter book, and that just kind of came about 2.5 months ago. So, and that one will just be called Christmas at Mimosa Lake, The Nativity. And, you know, you had a person on who's making a movie, and
mm-hmm.
I did that. I started The Nativity, and then somebody approached me about doing something from the Mimosa Lake series for film, and I have I come from a family of theater people, but I don't have any history or experience with that at all. So that's kind of I thought that was interesting your guest was talking about before, because I have no experience with that, and we're just kind of getting started with that and looking at if that's workable or not. I've talked to the filmmaker twice, and so the Christmas story actually may come out as a short, you know, as a film, you know, so.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
So tell us what Warm Days at Lita Lake, or Lita Clay. What is the what's the difference in this book versus the first book?
Okay. What's the difference in Warm Days and Lita Clay is they're dealing with a different issue. You're dealing with basically faith and growth and with the unexpected. What happens when one thing in your life after another comes at you, and how do you deal with that? And so those are the challenges that are kind of put forth in the book. And also I'll tell you that with each book, the storyline deepens because you get to know the people that are. One of the things that readers say back to me that I like is that in the first book, you know, there's people to get to know, and you know them each. You go into their home and kind of get to know them. But they're... But I feel like I'm really with these people, and they're really real, is what the readers will say to me, and that I've just visited with them, kind of, you know, and I can identify with them. So in the second book, a few of the characters are brought more to the forefront, and a little bit more history is explained, and then also some real challenges that they face. There's a character who's a very, very lovable, kind of practical joker guy at the lake, finds out that he's fathered a child he knew nothing about, and she's almost 30. So I mean, we have that kind of thing going around. There's challenges with people that are tension and wanting to you know, there's an affair growing. There's a troubled teenager who shows up and unexpectedly and throws everything into a. So it's just, there's a lot of different storylines there. But basically the main difference, I think, almost from book to book, is that you get to know the neighbors more and that people, you know, identify with it more. But there's more, there's the storyline in the first book is present, but it deepens in the second book. And on
right. I think that like I love series. I love a series. I love a book series because I get mm-hmm. like you were saying, I get so addicted to the characters that
right.
you're just like, and for me, like I, if it's an old series that I didn't know anything about, I just download one after the other, and I'm like, I can't stop reading it because I want to know what happens next, and you know, with characters, you know, and
yeah,
I think
yeah.
that makes it. For a great, great book, and it makes for a great, you know, great reading.
It also puts pressure on the writer. You're a writer who knows this, who you know how your readers are. They want more if they like it. They want more. You don't want them to want less. But at the same time, it's like, when is the next one? When is it?
I know. That's how I am. I'm like, oh, I gotta read the next one. Like, the,
right.
you know,
see,
I mean,
your writer's
like,
reality, and then the reality of your characters that are pressing on you all the time. Tell this story. Tell that story. You know, they become like people.
Yeah.
Too, like.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. I think when you write, especially when you're writing fiction,
mm-hmm.
people are just like, and you're writing, and they know it's a series. They want the next book. I mean, they just do. And it's like, I don't know how. Authors do it to keep up because it's a lot of work to write a book. It's a lot of work to write a book. You know,
write a book well. You know, to write it
yeah,
really is.
Absolutely.
Does anybody pretty much write stuff and throw it out there? It's just the stay in time. People, that's what people can do. But, and you know, I am not opposed to that. I'm glad that we're living in the time we are and that we have the freedom as independent authors to do this more. I mean, I remember the days of. You know, I'm having my work submitted and approved or rejected, and, you know, those are,
yeah.
I realized with independent publishing that this is a great thing, but at the same time, you really have to sift through if you're a reader to kind of, you know, you'll read good and bad, you know, so.
Yeah, and there's a lot, it's just made a lot more things available, a lot more books out
mm-hmm.
there, and that kind of makes it, you know, I know for me with my book, Just Believe, I see it, the ranking on Amazon, you know, you watch where it's ranking
right.
and you're, I mean, how do people find it? You know, I mean,
yeah,
how do they
yeah.
just really find it if they don't know who I am or they don't, you know, listen to my show or they don't, you know my work. I mean, it's not just, I mean, there are millions and millions of books out there that people, you know, that people can find, but I don't know. It sometimes blows my mind that people just, you know.
Well, it does. And you watch the ranking go down, you know, and when it's been way up and then it drops or something and you think, oh,
yeah,
my
and
God.
You're like, why? What happened?
No, yeah, and this morning and thinking about your show, Lisa, and the title and everything, I thought, you know, it's, I'm a workaholic because I love my work. It doesn't even feel like work to me. I mean, I love to market. I teach. Writing students, I do editing too, but so I love my work. I love each different aspect of it, but, you know, there comes a time, I think, too, when you get on the internet, or when I do, I get pressured. There's got to be something else I'm doing. And your show,
yeah.
I'm thinking about it this morning, I thought, you know, you just have to sometimes sit back and just believe that
right.
you're going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's crazy because, you know, it was like, you know, it's such a simple concept and it's such a simple title and it's two words.
Well,
and, you know, everybody's like, so what's the subtitle of the book? I'm like, there isn't one. That's the whole point. It's like,
no, well, right.
Please.
And isn't that enough? I mean, come on. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And I'm like, I'm not trying to tell people what to believe. I'm just saying, believe in something, you know, whatever
oh, right,
it is.
Right.
Be passionate about it. And,
that's,
you know, get saying
right.
that. I know that you were saying that the series deals with faith and different aspects of life, and I'm wondering if you can explain what that's all about. How did you bring the idea of faith and you know, just the spiritual side of things into the story that you're telling?
Okay, yeah, I did. That's an interesting question. Gently is how I did it. I tell you what, I was raised Episcopalian and am a Christian, but I am fairly pretty liberal in my spiritual beliefs and system, and know a lot of people with different backgrounds and beliefs. And in my neck of the woods, it's a probably much more conservative than where you are, but I have no desire to push any specific set of beliefs on anybody. But I stand firm in the fact that that there is through my life God permeates. God permeates throughout my life, and I had before I did this and before I took my last job, I had worked through and done some study at seminary in the ministry and determined that pastoring probably wasn't my gig. It probably wasn't for me. But there was something I needed to do in a ministry sense, and this is it. I mean, writing is my gift, and so I thought there's got to be a way to work this in. So how I do that is gently, basically. And you know, I when my first editor read my book, she said the first book, she said, you know, I don't even think I'd put anything about Christian fiction in here, or if it, she said it's just a very good story with faith, and so I liked that. I thought that was good. The characters rely on their beliefs and their values. They rely on God. And you know, some of the most righteous characters have some of the most difficulty, and some of those that are really searching, you know, have different issues that they deal with. So it's a weaving of really telling the person's story first, but because God so easily permeates through all of my life, I don't think it's difficult to have that happen with the characters where that's appropriate to do, you know. So I'm trying to think of a good example. You know, just when River, the character, sees this eagle, which she does, this was kind of taken from a person, from my own personal, you know, she can't help but imagine that is a sign, because things are so difficult. And I think we all do this in our own lives. We look for signs of the good. We fear, you know, when we feel fear, we know we're away from the good, you know, we kind of run. But we look for things and we have hope. And really, what I want the reader to leave with above anything is a sense of hope. The books are about hope, and that's what I try to do. You know, I try to leave them gently with anything that's going to hit them over the head would be hope more than anything. That no matter what, you know, we rely on our own resources, we rely on our relationships with other people, because that's really what it's about, and God, and we'll get through.
Right.
No matter
what,
you know, so.
So, what do you think was most interesting about writing the latest book, Warm Days, and Lita Clay?
Yeah, and the third book, the one I just finished is called Spring Sprouts and Fall Ashes. Piecing it together, I'm really rigid in my setup and how I set my work up, and then I have a checking process to make sure that my storyline runs right and everything, because you're dealing with a lot of people. So
right.
What's interesting always about writing for me, especially fiction, because I don't it really was not, like I said, my background other than children's books to write fiction. I set all this stuff up because I'm like somewhat anal, you know. So I've got my whole thing up on my wall. I put maps on my wall and drawings of how this is all going to go. And then I sit down to write and I let go. And so I know a general idea of what I'm writing because I've got it mapped out to a certain degree. But then where the story goes to and who comes in and what comes in just really blows my mind. And I've heard writers talk about this a million times on a million different television and radio shows, that something takes over and the characters take over and the work has a life of its own. And it really becomes, for me, I write the main book from January through about April is when I'm writing the main book usually every year. And so it just takes over my life and I live in that world. And that is so cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's, it's not really your life, but
yeah.
That is cool.
So
yeah, I love that, and I you know, and I know that this River Ivory is your main character in your series.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that you said, like, in the last book, Warm Days at and Lita Clay, that she kind of takes a back seat.
Yes.
So why did you do that? Was it in an effort to develop new characters or the older or other characters that were in the first book?
It just is the way that when I dealt with the main theme of the unexpected, she was just at a place where I think that while there were some things that happened to her that were not expected, that there were other things that just happened to other characters that kind of were bigger issues to look at. So that's how I kind of judge that. However, I'll tell you that in every book, and I do a kind of book by the numbers before I send it to my editor to see how many places the characters are in and everything. She's always at the top there. But the storyline, just as the storyline goes, depends on, you know, who's kind of front and center or not. And there were a lot of people coming in from the outside in Warm Days and Lita Clay and just a lot of things falling around and weird stuff happening like we have now, weather occurrences and stuff that make you sit back and think, what on earth is going on here? You know,
yeah, just, what's going on in the world? Yeah.
Yeah, what is going on in the world kind of thing. Right, yeah,
right.
Exactly. And this next one is about challenges, basically. So there were several challenges that, you know, people met, and she has a little bit more of a role there. But just as in real life, you know, characters' lives settle down and they kind of flare up. I mean, we all go through these kind of things. So yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what do you think's going on with you know, not only this book, but what pulls the readers into the whole series? I mean, each book, is it something different, or is it, you know, what do you think people are attracted to about the series?
I think they like it because this is what I hear back. They love River. They love her. They like the idea of a life like that. They like the idea of a life that's somewhat immersed in nature, and that is immersed in relationships. They like the relationships. They like the fact that it's that no matter what they go through, that it always ends. The stories always end hopefully. They always end with hope. I think that's a big thing. And then just that they know the characters and they get caught up with the characters and they just want to know what is happening now with them. So they're interesting characters. And a lot of people have said to me, I know somebody like this, or I know somebody like this, or people that live near me will say, this is this person, or no.
Really? Yeah, so the connecting is to somebody in your life,
that's my neighbors, and a few of my, I have a readers club that I bounce my books off and stuff to, and they, you know, somebody in my readers club said about a year and a half ago, you know what's going to happen, people are going to come to where you live, you know, when these books get more around, they're going to come to where you live, and you're, and you know, it never occurred to me. But some people have out here now to see them. So I think, my gosh, you know, they're really expecting to see these people out here. So it's kind of fun that way, you know. But I really think it's the I hope it's the hope, but I think it's that they know people. They feel like these characters are their friends. They know them. They know about intimate things in their lives. And,
right.
And it makes us all feel less alone if they're kind of, you know, as much as I see about the coast and what goes on and on and on and on from my perspective here, or, you know, when I run up to Chicago or run here or there, it's, you know, it's a different kind of life than a lot of people lead, you know.
Right.
So there's a wishfulness about that, you know. Oh, yeah, I wish I could live on a lake in the trees where everybody, you know, has fun and, you know, that kind of thing.
I always wondered, and this is a funny question, but I've always wondered, like, as the author,
of a series or of a book at all, but especially a series of books. Do you have a favorite character?
It changes, not really. It changes.
It
changes with who. I'll tell you one thing that's kind of on that is that, you know, that one of them becomes kind of more fun than another one, or you feel sorry for them. A friend of mine said, who's a writer, and she's written a series for teens, and she wrote her second book, and it was a very difficult book. The characters went through a lot, and so I said to her, you're glad that, you know, you're on your third book or whatever, and she said, yeah. She said, I don't want to put my characters through that. I don't want to put them through that kind of thing again. And you do get that way, you know, with them too. But one favorite character over another, I don't really think so. I love River. I love Georgia Lemon. Doc Creighton is a lot of fun. Franklin Sheldon has a leg that's been amputated from a lawnmower accident, and when he was in the hospital, people went to visit him, and he said, you know, don't want to stay too long or you'll have to have an arm or leg. They'll have to give the hospital an arm or leg to get out of here, kind of thing. So, you know,
right.
they all got different things. So, yeah, it changes.
So one of the things I noticed with a series is sometimes I feel like if I'm reading, like sometimes I won't know it's a series. And I'll pick up all these, it'd be like, oh, this book sounds interesting, and I'll grab it and read it. And then I feel like I'm kind of lost because I feel like, oh, gosh, I didn't read the first book. So, you know, now it's not like, I feel like I've missed something. Is your book like that, or can somebody just, like, read the book number three or book number two and not need to have read one?
Yeah, I try to really watch that because I've found that too before where I've read a series and I've read like the third one or something and then I'm like, uh-oh, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, I try to watch that. I try to bring people up to date to some degree with bits of history. But, you know, that's one thing I do notice, Lisa, is that as the books go on, that I'm reaching back a little bit less. And so that is something that I watch for and that my editor watches for, too, so that you have a frame of reference so that the books can stand alone, you know.
Usually, like, if I find out, like, most of my books I download now, unless it's somebody that's going to be on the show and they send me the actual hard copy, and then usually I don't read it because I'm so used to reading from my Kindle or from, you know, it's just, like, my way of reading books now, but... When I noticed that if I download, like, that sounds interesting or shows up in you might like this, you know, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
I'll see right away, it'll say book two or book four or something like that. And I'm like, well, crap. So I go back and I download them in order. 1, 2, 3, you know. So I end up buying 4 of this author's books because I want to start at the very beginning. I've noticed though that some of them don't say book one, book two, book three, you know, of a series, and I think that's confusing for people. But
I think
you
so
know,
too, and that's a good point to make too. I like my work has been compared to Jan Corinne's work. Do you know her?
What's the name again?
Jan Corinne. K A R O N. She did the Father's. I'm trying to think. The Mitford series.
Oh, I've heard of that.
I love her books. I do love her books, but I noticed that too. She wrote a long series too, like I'm doing. I have 8 planned, and now I have almost 3 Christmas ones planned too that are novellas. But anyway, the thing is that some books are just going to hit you more than others. So. That's why it's important to have them stand alone, too, so that there's a story about, that's why I wrap it around a main theme, you know, faith in hard times or faith in the unexpected or faith in challenges or blah, blah, blah. So, because it's just a, you know, the story does, you know, it's going to mean more to you, I think, in the third book if you know the history of the first book or the second book. And new neighbors come in. So, you know, I mean, people come in and the storyline changes. And the bottom line in what we're all reading in books is we want a story. You know, we want a good story.
And right.
So every book has to stand alone in the fact that, you know, and be a good story. So.
Right. Agreed. I agree. So in Warm Days and Lee DeClay, how what's the trigger event? What's the main trigger event in the book?
Warm Days and Lee DeClay. Well, the trigger event, I think there are a couple of them. One is that there's a storm that happens. And another trigger event, I think I mentioned earlier, but no, is that there's an organization that runs the neighborhood called the MOB, Mimosa Lake Organizing Board, and the president, who's a very, very colorful woman, she's an older lady, and her name is Georgia Lemon, and she's a very powerful woman and very in control, but her family, one of her issues is that her older children all live, you know, far away, and there's not much contact there. So she lives in a huge house on a hill, and she's pretty controlling. Well, she has a real troubled granddaughter that shows up, and that helps her to become more real of a person. And also the dynamics of that girl that ripple through the neighborhood, because she becomes involved with people. And then we have a pastor Jack Daniels and his wife Nikita move into the neighborhood. So those are kind of the trigger things that happen, I think, and they're kind of sprinkled through the book. But
what's the character that is most prevalent in this book, or maybe that grows or, you know, has the most changes, the focus in this book?
Okay. I think that's probably Franklin Sheldon, because he is the person that finds out early on in the book that he's the person with the amputated leg, and he walks. He's a walker, and he walks around the neighborhood. So we always get his perspective. He's a retired professor, college professor. So we always get his perspective from kind of an intellectual, intellectually filtered, you know, not too emotional way. And
right.
He has this crisis that occurs, and when he finds out that he has this daughter, and it disrupts his marriage, it disrupts his whole entire life. So he goes through quite a few stages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's. You know, I know that you have in the book, and in, I guess, both the books, now three books, you have a lot of characters. There are a lot of different characters. Do your readers like all the different characters? Because, like, sometimes when I'm reading a book, I'm like, oh, just keep it simple. Because if I'm reading, like, for fun, I just want it to be easy. So, you know, how does that flow, and do the readers respond well to that?
Okay. Yeah, I think that what I've gotten is that if a person reads beyond the third chapter of the first book, that they love it. So that's
okay.
What I, because somehow it comes. The first chapter of the first book, The Story of the Winter Visitor, brings in the different types of people, and then the rest of the book goes through and focuses on kind of one person, and then adds another person, so then they kind of begin to know. So and then another thing I've done is, and I've reconsidered this too. I've put a map in the books so that you can see where the neighbors are, where they live around the lake, and how the lake looks.
Oh, that's cool.
And
yeah,
people have said to me, well, you know, if I were, then I just went back and said, okay, that's where they live. So they kind of get people together. So, yeah. So I know what you're saying, and that is a challenge anytime you're dealing with a group of characters, because it's a
lot easier
in some sense. Yeah, it's a lot easier in some ways to just do one character, one story, and one storyline with supporting, and then you're done. You know, but that wasn't, and you know, and I've looked at that too, but not with this series, with another series, but. But that's, you know, to me, this was the story that I wanted to tell about a group of people, you know, about a place. And, And really, Mimosa Lake is the, you know, it's almost like a character in itself.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that makes sense, because that happens when it's a community thing. It does become like, you know, like its own mm-hmm. character.
And, you know, I'm able to bind them with time. I mean, time is very, very specific in there, and the time frame, because you have to, when you deal with more than, you know, one character like that, or you're dealing with a group of like 6 to 7 main people that come, that are neighbors there, then you need to make some things very, very constant. So what's constant in the book are time and place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about, what that worries you. You know what, I'm just wondering, and I don't want to put you on, I don't want to put you on the spot if you're not prepared, but do you have a favorite passage that you want maybe to read to our listeners today?
Well, I could grab the book real quick, one of the books, and figure out one of them. Let's see, because I'm not at my desk. I'm somewhere else. You know, I wish I did. Hold on.
I'm just curious. Like, I know, like, people ask me that about my book all the time, and I'm like, it's hard for me to pick one, but mine's not fiction, you know? So I think sometimes with fiction, you have a, you know, there's just something that you feel like, wow, I really wrote that well. I did a really good job at that, you know? And that's that. Or it just kind of sums up, you know, you can have it like a section or a piece that kind of just sums up the way the book is written, you know, like what it's not only about, but the theme of the book almost. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Let's see. Well,
as she thumbs through her book, I have now put her on the spot.
Yeah. Actually, you know, my favorite passages, they're always the ones you just wrote. But let me tell you, Warm Days and Lita Clay, which is the second book. The book opens with River, in essence, burying. She lives alone. She's burying her dog, who is like, she's almost chosen to stay out of, when she came to Mimosa Lake, she'd had 4 relationships within 4 years. She bought a house for one. She decided to work as a painter. So she's made this whole change, and she has this dog. And Rue was the dog's name. And the dog died unexpectedly. So the book opens with her digging in the dirt, and you don't know why she's digging in the dirt, and she's saying it's a beautiful April afternoon. And then you look over, and you know from the first book, in essence, but you learn this in the second book, that Rue is basically, in essence, Rue has taken over her. She's placed on Rue what she doesn't want to place on anyone else. She's closed up, okay? So
right.
Rue is dead, and she deals with this through the book. And it's really, really hard. So one way she deals with it is she decides to paint Rue. And then at the end of the book, and I'll read this passage, then she paints Rue, and she has a nephew, Taylor, who comes at Thanksgiving time. The round red front door opened, and he leaned in. "What are you doing here in the dark, Aunt River?" Taylor stepped inside and saw her thin silhouette against the row of windows that faced the street. "It's cold in here." "Taylor, you'll be the first to see it completed. I'm taking it over to hang in the house." She turned the painting toward him. His eyes and the silence said it all. He responded with a softened voice, "Wow, wow, Aunt River. I knew you were good with the eagles, but this is the best you've ever done." River's eyes stung for a moment in the dim light. "Thanks, Tay. Will you carry it to the house and help me hang it?" He carefully took the painting from her and carried it across the driveway. Once inside, they placed it before River got the hangers. "Let me nail a hanger in, and then you can be sure it's straight." Taylor nailed it in the hanger and then carefully placed the picture on the east dining room wall that faced the front door in the living room. "Oh," River gasped, a small gasp. "Look at it, Tay. Can you see it?" Now it was River's turn to be amazed. "I've never seen it. I you think it's the evening light?" What? Taylor couldn't see anything. He came down into the living room and stood by his aunt. His eyes widened as he saw what seemed to be unbelievable. I don't know. I don't know. They stood together as Rue's image glowed in the light. River had seen this somewhere before. Rue was running, her husky face joyfully, as if she was in chase of a rabbit or about to run into the lake for a swim. Her blue eyes were focused on, and her white and gray fur was alive with life. She looked as if she could run right to them. Rue was as River intended. How did you get that glow all around her? Aunt River, Taylor asked. I didn't, she answered. River knew that this painting was her best work ever, but it wasn't her work alone. She knew that as well. So it changed from what you thought it would be? You didn't expect it to look like that? He asked. I never expected it, River answered. And that's the end.
I love that. That's beautiful. I can't wait to read the series. I mean, I definitely am going to I'm going to download them. I did not read them yet. I mean, I've read the basics about them, but I didn't actually get to read any of the series. But tell everyone, because we're down to our last few minutes, what are the three books? I mean, the series is Life at Mimosa Lake, mm-hmm. and the first book is called. Just go ahead and tell everybody what the three books are and where they can find them.
Sure. The first book, the series for women is Life at Mimosa Lake, and the first book is called The Story of the Winter Visitor. The second book is called Warm Days on Lita Clay. And the third book will be out in early fall. That one's called Life at Mimosa Lake. And then the subtitle is Spring Sprouts and Fall Ashes. And then in October, Christmas at Mimosa Lake will be out, and the subtitle of that is The Nativity. So, and they can find them, of course, at Amazon. And you can just put in Life at Mimosa Lake, and it'll take you to my author homepage. And then my children's books are there too. So that's where they can find it, or my website, which is kswerts.com, kswerts.com. That's kind of where they can get me at. You can find phone numbers, you can find emails, you can find all that there.
All right, that's great. I really appreciate your being on the show. I can't wait to read the series. It's it sounds really, really interesting, and it's really nice to have something that ends up, you know, fictional series that is upbeat and, and gives and has a spiritual spin to it. So I really love that, about the idea of the whole series. So thanks again for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for having me so much, and I look forward to reading your book, too. It sounds very good.
Oh, thank you.
You bet.
I hope people start buying it someday now. It's
they will.
Fun,
of course they will. Yeah, I'll run in there and grab a copy. It's got to be on Amazon, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's on, it's everywhere. It's in itself. It's doing okay. It's just like, one of many, many, many spiritual
that's
books.
Way, and, that's always the way. Yeah, I'm on Smashwords and Apple and Barnes & Noble and all of that, too, so people can always find us. But I do look forward to reading and seeing what you have to say, too, so that'll be fun for me. So,
oh, great. Well, I really look forward to reading your whole series. I'm very excited about it. I'll be bugging you, though. I'll be like, all right, hurry up, write the next one.
There we go. Okay. Thanks so much, and have a happy Father's Day, Lise.
Thank you. You do, and I will, like I said, I will be in touch and definitely hope to get you back on the show. Maybe around Christmas when your Christmas book comes out. That'd be fun.
Oh, I'd love that. That should be out in November. That sounds great. We'll be in touch.
Yeah.
Sounds...
All
okay.
Right, good. Thanks.
Now. Bye.
Thanks, Kim. Bye.
Thanks.
So, everybody, that was our show for the day. Just Believe Radio. Two great guests. First, we had Chad Meek, and he is promoting the Giant Rock, the movie, and his website is Giant Rock, the movie. It sounds like .com. It sounds like it's going to be a fascinating movie that's coming out soon. So I am looking forward to following up on that. And then we had the author of the series Life at Mimosa Lake.
Kim works, and I'm looking forward to reading what she's got out there. So check, make sure you check her email or her website out too, kswertz.com, and check out her books on Amazon. I think everybody will be fascinated by the series. I'm looking forward to reading it. Anyway, you know, show started off with some technical issues, as per the norm with all my shows for some reason. Not all of them, but, you know, I would say half. But, you know, I hit some wrong buttons and had some calls coming in at the wrong time and all of that. But, hey, this is live radio for you people. Anyway, so every week, Just Believe Radio airs at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and we are going to be having, I've got a great summer of shows already booked up, an amazing group of people with some amazing different things to talk about. So we're gonna just keep watching, checking out my my webpage, which is www.lisatarvis.com. If you miss a live show on Sunday, you can always catch it in the archives. You can catch it in the archives either, well, actually, it's just easiest to access it from my webpage at the top. Just click on Just Believe Radio, and all the shows are listed there that I've done, the topic of the show, the name of the show, and then you can listen to it right from my website. So definitely go to Lisa Tarvis, LisaTarves.com, and you'll also find links to my Facebook page, my Twitter account, my LinkedIn, you know, everything else that all the other social networking sites that I'm on. And you'll also find links on my webpage to where you can buy my book, Just Believe, which I talked about earlier in the show when I was trying to fill some time. And when I'm on lots of different shows, I'll be on a show tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Love to tell you. Well, let me see. I could probably tell you what it is if I don't run out of time here. But tomorrow I will be appearing on a show called Journey for Truth, and it is actually going to be on at 1:30 Eastern. And so I'll be sending links out to that show. If you're following me on Facebook or Twitter, you'll be able to see the links. But that's tomorrow at 1:30. And tomorrow happens to be my birthday. So as a birthday gift, you could all listen to that show. And that would be great. Anyway, so it was another great show. Everybody have a happy and safe week. All the dads out there, happy Father's Day. Enjoy your day. Thanks for everything you do. And everyone, thanks for listening. And I will talk to everyone next week. Bye-bye.